I wonder how many of you remember the Back to the Future movies. That brings back some memories, doesn't it? It was about traveling back and forth in time with a modified DeLorean. That's a car. What you can see, there's a picture. I have to say, my favorite of those was the Back to the Future 3, where they traveled back in time to the 1800s. And now the whole Back to the Future thing is sort of part of our culture. Most everybody is aware of it. We understand it. You know, Marty and Doc, they went back to the 1800s and tried to change some events that were needing to be changed from their estimation. But I was thinking about that in relation to our trying to understand the times of Daniel. What if someone from back then, let's say the 1800s, were to come back to or ahead to our time now? I mean, we've had those kinds of thoughts before. But if someone were to come and drop into America and read our newspapers or whatever, would they understand our times in relation to what they would have understood of what America was all about back then? I mean, there's a lot of changes that have taken place in that amount. Even over our own lifetimes, if you think about it, there's been so much just over the last few years, just over the last few weeks, there has been so much that has been happening. Would they understand our current political environment? We don't even understand our current political environment. Would they understand what's going on with our moral climate, the sexual revolution, and all of that? We don't even understand what's going on with that. We can't even keep up with it. They can't even keep up with it. It keeps changing. Would they understand our current economic situation? That we are in debt, how many trillions of dollars? What's a trillion? I mean, remember when you were a kid and you worked for 50 cents an hour? Did you ever think you'd have to talk about trillions of dollars and then indebtedness of our nation? That is incredible. So much has changed, not only technologically, but sociologically. And that has been huge. But we are going back in time to try to understand what life was like about 2,600 years ago. How was it the same? How was it different? How much has changed since then? How many parallels are there? How many similarities? I suspect there are plenty in that we're still dealing with common human nature. And so there are going to be some things that are going to carry over that we will be able to understand, even though a lot has changed in many ways. And not just thinking about our technological advances. I mean, we are accustomed to having hot and cold running water in our homes. And we have a hard time imagining a day without that. Well, they never had any of that. So it was a different world. So, but before we begin our examination of the text of Daniel, I want to spend a little bit more time. We started last time looking at the general background of the book. The context of Bible college or seminary situation, the area that we're talking about would be called a biblical introduction, or Old Testament introduction, or New Testament introduction. It's dealing with the backgrounds of the books that were written, what was going on, who was the author, all of that sort of thing. And so it's a technical field of study. There is a lot there, and we're hoping to at least get a little bit of a glimpse of it so that when we come to the text, we have a little bit of understanding of when, where, how all of these things took place. We'll just get an overview now. We'll look at more detail as we get into it. So we want to consider the historical context of the book, the purpose of writing, as well as the theological emphasis, some of those kinds of things. So, starting with the historical background and the setting of the book of Daniel. Now, every book of the Bible that is written in some context, and so it helps to know what that context is. And we want to start with the stages of the fall of Jerusalem and Judah. And if we look at the first few verses of Daniel, which we did touch on last time, I'll just review them. Daniel chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. That's the starting point. And it introduces us to several different people. But it gives us a context, saying this book took place in a context. The details that are given here, we want to try to understand. And so what we see here is an invasion by Babylon of Jerusalem. And it's interesting, in verse 2, it doesn't say Nebuchadnezzar, in his great might, destroyed Jerusalem. Now, you would think that in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, he would have probably thought that, but it says the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. And that's a good thing to remember, that, and that's part of the emphasis of this book, is the Lord is directing things throughout the process. But we want to start by thinking about Daniel, because he's going to be introduced in this first chapter, and we'll be looking more at that in the future. But Daniel was born during the reign of the last good king of Judah, about 621 BC. If you have a timeline in your head, it helps to be able to kind of see where things are. So about 621 BC is the rough time frame that we're looking at here. He was born during the reign of King Josiah, and he lived through the last four bad kings of Judah, and then well beyond that. And then this, of course, was about 100 years after Isaiah gave his prophecies. Israel had been invaded during Isaiah's time, invaded by Assyria in 722 BC. And so you can see it's about 100 years difference between when the northern kingdom of Israel was defeated and when Daniel was born. So 722 was the invasion by Assyria of Israel, and Daniel was born about 621 BC. So, and we've just been through the book of Isaiah not long ago, so hopefully that's reasonably fresh on your mind, although more than 2 weeks have gone by since then, so I recognize there's a little bit of loss in that process. But what had happened to Israel should have been somewhat on the minds of the people of Judah, should have been a lesson to them, a warning to them. The defeat of Israel had taken place during the reign of good King Hezekiah, who reigned in Judah for about 20 years. Then his son Manasseh was king for 55 years, and he, for almost all of his reign, was very evil and had a very evil influence on that nation. Then Ammon for just a little bit, and then followed by Josiah, who was a good king for 31 years, and that was the king under whom Daniel was born. And then there was a succession of four bad kings: Jehoahaz, who reigned for 3 months, Jehoiakim, who reigned for 11 years, Jehoiachin, who reigned for 3 months, and Zedekiah, who reigned for 11 years. So they had sort of a system going on there. 3 months, 11 years, 3 months, 11 years. If you get that down, then you pretty much have it. They didn't really last all that long, and there was a little bit of history and story behind them as well. But what we basically see is for the last several years, there, while there was an intermixing of some good kings and predominantly, or at least almost all, at least of the latter ones, were more evil than good. But the nation was in a state of decline and basically having persistent disobedience to Yahweh. So it's not hard to see some parallels, I think, with our own time and nation. We've had good leaders and bad leaders, and the bad leaders usually bring on some bad things to our society, and the good kings, good leaders, try to bring in some good things. And so we have observed that. We have seen how a nation can decline over time and how other nations take advantage of that declining social situation, as well as the inevitable political and power decline in the process. In our day, we see the church losing its influence and effectiveness in society, in addition to its freedom. And we're also dealing with the targeting of those that are associated with the church because they are seen as obstacles to the agendas of the radical socialist ideologies, such as abortion, LGBTQ+, and socialism, and those, the basic institutions of our society are being eroded away, changing, redefined, and all of that. And so we see that happening. That is not unusual in the history of nations to see that taking place. It's not encouraging in that regard. But the one hope that we should have is there has always been a remnant, those who have stayed true to the Lord. We want to keep focused on that aspect as well. Well, then the first invasion and the deportation of Babylon took place in 605 BC, when Prince Nebuchadnezzar led the Babylonian army of his father, Nabopolassar, against the allied forces of Egypt and Assyria. And then he defeated them at Carchemish, which was north of Israel, up near the Turkey and Syria border. And that victory gave Babylon supremacy in the ancient Near East. So Babylon was just ascending in its power at this time. Assyria had been the power before, but you see now that Babylon is moving, and Nebuchadnezzar was instrumental in bringing that to pass. With Babylon's victory, then Egypt's vassals, those that were subjected in some form or another under Egypt, Egypt had control over that basic area, those countries that included Judah passed under Babylonian control. So shortly thereafter, the same year, Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, died, and Nebuchadnezzar succeeded him as king, again, 605 BC. So then Nebuchadnezzar moved south and invaded Judah of that same year that he took power. So he took some of the royal people, the nobles, captive, as we saw in the text here, including Daniel, plus and his three friends, and probably many others, and as well as vessels from Solomon's temple. And that was the first of Judah's deportations from their land to Babylon. And the king of Judah at that time was Jehoiakim, as was noted in the text here in verse 2 of Daniel chapter 1. And it's also referenced in 2 Kings 24, 1-4, if you want to get another view on that. Then the second invasion and deportation to Babylon took place in 597 B.C. Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiachin, also known as Jeconiah and Coniah, it's helpful to remember Bob and Robert, you know, they have different variations of a name, succeeded him in 598 B.C. Jehoiachin resigned only 3 months and 10 days later. 2 Chronicles 36:9 reminds us of that. Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah again in March of 597 B.C. 2 Kings 24:10 tells us about that. At the turn of the year in 597 B.C., he took Jehoiachin to Babylon along with most of Judah's remaining leaders, including Ezekiel. So Ezekiel was taken during that second invasion and deportation. And the rest of the national treasures were taken. 2 Kings 24, 2 Chronicles 36 also give us some information on that. Then we have the third invasion and deportation to Babylon, 586 B.C. This deportation took place about 11 years later. And Jehoiakim's younger brother, Mattaniah, whose name had been changed by Nebuchadnezzar to Zedekiah, was Judah's puppet king. So they were basically taken over. They took one of the people and said, "Okay, well, I'm going to make you the king. Do as I say, and then all you have to do is not do what he says, and then you get in big trouble." He rebelled against Babylon's sovereignty by secretly making a treaty with Pharaoh Hophra under pressure from Jewish nationalists. Jeremiah 37-38 gives us some more information on that. After an 18-month siege, Jerusalem fell in July 586 B.C., also noted in 2 Chronicles 36. Nebuchadnezzar then returned to Jerusalem. He burned the temple. He broke down the city walls. He took all but the poorest of the Jews captive to Babylon. And he also took Zedekiah prisoner to Babylon, and there he executed his sons in front of him and then put out his eyes at Ribla in Aram, or modern-day Syria. 2 Kings 24:18 through 25:24 gives you the background there. So I realize a lot of details, but trying to give a little bit of a picture of what was going on while Daniel's life was being lived out most of the time in Babylon. But this was going on in Israel. And then there's a fourth but smaller deportation, often not even mentioned. Usually it's the three main ones that are referenced, but this one also took place in 583 B.C. It occurred after Gedaliah, the puppet governor that was there after Zedekiah, was assassinated by Jewish radicals. Fearing Babylonian reprisal, they fled to Egypt, taking Jeremiah with them. And so we have reference to each of these people who were living at this same time. The Babylonians did come and take a fourth group into exile. 2 Kings 25 and Jeremiah 52:30 give us some information on that as well. So there was a progression of the total devastation that was taking place in Judah that would remove it from its prominence that it had had for centuries in that part of the land. They were now removed from their land. And so it's really a testament to the effects of disobedience to God and His expectations. And it was a progression. It was in several different movements, and it continued on. And so essentially the times of the Gentiles had been inaugurated at this time by the initial work that Nebuchadnezzar had done. So that brings us then to the next matter of consideration, and that is the writing of the book of Daniel. When did that take place? We need to start with the influence of presuppositions. Because the dating of the book is one of the most controversial subjects in Old Testament introduction studies. It's a big deal. When did Daniel write? And the controversy is not over the matter of whether there's enough evidence for when Daniel wrote, because there is plenty of evidence. It's a matter of presuppositions that don't fit with some of the viewpoints. It's actually quite easy to determine when Daniel lived and when he ministered because of all the historical references in the book. So he makes that rather clear. His fellow prophet Ezekiel also referred to him as a righteous man, Ezekiel 14, verses 14 and 20, and chapter 28, verse 3. Ezekiel knew of Daniel. But because the book contains prophecies regarding Antiochus Epiphanes that were fulfilled in the second century, very specifically, many rationalistic critics who deny the Bible, that they think it can't have predictive prophecy because that would be something out of the ordinary, supernatural. They say Daniel couldn't have written it because how would he have known? That just doesn't happen. Well, unless there's a God who is powerful enough to bring that to pass. So they contend that it must have been written after Antiochus, which would have been about 165 B.C. So most modern critics follow the late date, even though there are many evidences in the book that would contradict that and would suggest that its origin was in the 6th century B.C. So in light of that little bit of discussion, what is a reasonable date for writing then? Well, Daniel lived well beyond the time described in Daniel 10:1, where we read, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. That was 536 B.C. So it seems probable that he wrote the book shortly after this date and before 530 B.C. So it would have been in that time frame between 536 and 530 B.C. And so it's probably somewhere in there where he put the final form of his writing out there to be accessible under the superintendence of the Holy Spirit, that he would make it available to the world to use and to understand, to the Jews as well. And that seeking to understand it is our task as well. So that brings us then to the purpose and theology of the book of Daniel. What is its intended purpose? What was he wanting to communicate? Well, it is to be an encouragement to a defeated people. We may feel that way today at times, and we can appreciate this. It seems that maybe to the casual observer of Israel's situation in Daniel's time, that Yahweh had either become impotent or had abandoned his chosen people because they had been taken into exile. That is not a very positive thing. And as we think about our own nation, we see things going in a direction that we are not at all happy about, and we can be a little concerned as well, to put it mildly. So for all intents and purposes, it appeared to those who were looking on that the gods of Assyria and Babylon had triumphed over Yahweh. And that would have been the mindset, kind of like secularism today. It's winning, we're losing. What does that mean? Is God on vacation? We know that he works things out in a longer time frame than what we may like to see. Because the temple was in ruins, the capital had been ravaged, it stood empty, it was vulnerable, the walls had been knocked down, people were living as unhappy captives in a foreign land. Now, it's hard for us to imagine because we have had incredible tranquility in our nation over the years, other than the Civil War and a few other skirmishes, few of which have taken place on our soil, although some have. We have not experienced an aggressive army coming in and disrupting our lives to the point of removing us from our residence with everything that we had and displacing us into another place and saying, okay, now do what we say. I mean, that's hard to imagine. That's on a way different level than anything we've ever had to deal with. But that's what they had to deal with. And so it looked like they were a completely defeated people. And they were under discipline. And maybe we are. Who knows? Well, I think we have an idea if we think about where we are from where we once were. So this book is going to be showing God's revealing of himself through his supernatural power and what he's going to be doing in the future to say, it's not over. I am still here. There is still a work to be done. There will be a remnant. And so take courage. Also, it was to recognize and appreciate God's activity on the earth. He was still there, very much alive and well. He's displaying his power to demonstrate that he is the only one and true God, the God Most High, as is often referenced, that he is still sovereign over the affairs of humanity and history, that he manifested his power to the supreme rulers of Babylon and Persia, that they might know that he governs over everyone. And we see that noted many times, that he alone is God. None of these others are anything at all. And so this was a time in Israel's history that was also somewhat similar to what life was like before the Exodus, because the nation, before it was formally a nation, was in Egypt as basically a tribal people at that point. They were in captivity, and they were in a state of disgrace because they were being suppressed and that were there for 430 years, and God was going to move them out of that land to the promised land. And that's what Exodus is dealing with. And so there are some parallels there as well. God showing himself that he is going to provide for his people. One author noted, the prominent message is that God's people will experience suffering and be threatened with extinction, but that will not be the end of the story because their God is the living and all-powerful God who will get glory by vindicating his name and who will save them. And another perspective on it was from Charlie Dyer. Daniel's purpose in writing blended the two themes of prophecy and piety. He wrote first to show God's future program for the nation of Israel in light of her fall during and after the times of the Gentiles, and second, he wrote to show what the believer's present response should be as they await the coming of the kingdom of God. Daniel encouraged his readers to remain faithful to God in a hostile society while they waited for God's promised kingdom. And that should be an encouragement to us as well, because God is still at work. If he can work in the past, there's no reason to think he can't work in the future. And this is what this book is going to be indicating for us. And what we need to remember is just because the unrighteous gain control and appear to have the upper hand, it doesn't mean they actually do. And that is something important for us to remember. It may not look good, but that's no big deal for God. So then, what is the theological emphasis of Daniel? It provides clear testimony to the sovereignty of God. The overall sovereignty and transcendence of God above all angels and men strongly permeates the book. There's a theme that's running throughout the whole book, that the fortunes of kings and the affairs of men are subject to God's will. He has a plan he will bring to pass. That doesn't mean he meticulously causes every single thing that anyone does. He allows freedom But he uses our responses because he's that big of a God that he can do that. So he's able to accomplish his will despite and through even the most determined opposition of the most arrogant and mightiest rulers on earth. And that, I think, is helpful to be reminded of. So despite the collapse and fall of both Israel and Judah, the book of Daniel makes clear that the Lord God remains ultimately sovereign over human affairs. And this is apparent in the present, despite political and religious conditions that might suggest otherwise, and in the future, when there will be no doubt in anyone's mind, when the Lord returns and puts down all opposition and makes very clear that he is the sovereign ruler of all. So it also provides insight on God's redemptive plan. Daniel's prophecies also reveal the fulfillment of his great redemptive plan of the Messiah's coming, the coming prince. And this plan began at the fall, where it was revealed in Genesis chapter 3, and it will culminate in the return and the reign of Christ on the earth when the kingdom is established. All of that is working toward that end. Daniel sort of ties that together and shows this is where it's headed. It includes other related theological themes to point out. One is the power of prayer. That's emphasized in this book. God is working in response to his people's prayers, and especially so in the first six chapters and also chapters 9 and 10. And it also portrays the incredible grace of God, that even though his people had failed miserably, God revealed that he will not cast them off completely. He is going to continue to work with them, even though there will be a remnant that will return, that he will work through. That remnant is part of the picture that it continues to be seen. And so he is disciplining them presently, but he will continue to work through them in the future as a nation. And Romans 11 particularly brings that out as well. So he will fulfill his promises that he made to his people, going back to the patriarchs, to Abraham, Genesis chapter 3. Through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed, that your land will be yours and those of your children, and that is going to be, again, that fulfilling of the promises that are made. And then another theological emphasis is that it defines the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles is talked about in the New Testament as well. And it's that extended period of time in which the land, which was given by covenant from God to Abraham and his descendants, it would be occupied by Gentile powers. And the Davidic throne would be empty of any rightful heir in the Davidic line for a time. So it's that period of time. It begins with Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Jerusalem in 605 BC, and it will continue until the Messiah returns in the second advent, as is described, for instance, in Revelation chapter 19, where he comes back in glory and might and puts down, again, as we said, all opposition. So he is at work. Christ will subdue the nations. He will deliver the land from its Gentile occupants. He will bring the nation Israel into her covenanted blessings, and the millennial kingdom will be inaugurated. So it really covers a lot of ground, and it gives a broad overview of those things that are to come. And so Jesus saw it as something that was critical because he referenced it when he was giving his description of those things that are going to take place in the future in Matthew 24. It says, just like Daniel said, talking about the abomination of desolation. So he recognized that that is, and he saw it as yet future, not just during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes earlier on before Christ was born, but it's still going to take place. that brings us then to the outline and the lessons of the book, the basic outline of the book of Daniel. There are different ways that it can be done. Different people have done different things. This is the format that I am going to be looking at. Start with the character, and basically divide into three parts, I think, is the easiest. It's the most logical. It fits with the language differences that we had pointed out. Chapter 1, for the most part, is Hebrew. The last part of it is Hebrew, and then that section in between is in Aramaic, and that fits as well. So Chapter 1, the character of Daniel, intro to the book. It's laying out who the main characters are and tells you a bit about the character of Daniel and why that's going to be significant in the future. And then the second part of it is the times of the Gentiles, God's program for the world, chapters 2 through 7. And that's why that's in Aramaic. It's the more colloquial language, the trade language of the times. And so it's dealing with what's God's going to be doing there. And it starts off with, and I shortened Nebuchadnezzar's name because it's just too long to fit on a slide. Neb's first dream. How's that? The big picture, chapter 2. So Nebuchadnezzar's going to have this dream, and so this is kind of the big picture, and then later things are going to expand on this some. And then Neb's golden image, chapter 3. And that's not dealing with Daniel, but with his three friends. And then Neb's pride and humbling, another vision that he has relative to him losing his ability to function mentally. And so that's chapter 4. So Nebuchadnezzar's first dream, the big picture, chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar's golden image, chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar's pride and humbling, chapter 4. I assume you have that memorized by now. I'll give you another second. Joyce is still writing feverishly. If you can get a basic outline in your mind, it usually helps to kind of get a handle on the book. And if you can't get it all, email me and I can send you a copy of the PowerPoint and you can transcribe it at your leisure. All right, continuing. The next chapter, chapter 5, is Belshazzar's feast and fall. That's the handwriting on the wall. We're familiar with that picture. And then Darius's pride and Daniel's preservation. That's when Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den, chapter 6. We recognize those stories, but there's a lot there to pick up as well. And then Daniel's vision of future world history. Daniel has a vision here, and this could be bumped into the next section dealing with prophetic things, but it's still dealing with more world history, so it's included in the first part under the times of the Gentiles because it's really an expansion. Chapter 7 is really an expansion of chapter 2 in terms of that dealing with some of the same issues or the same historical characters as were brought up by Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Then the third section, chapters 8 through 12, Israel in relation to the Gentiles, God's program for Israel. So the middle section was dealing with the nations for the most part, and the final section has more to do with the implications for Israel. So Israel in relation to the Gentiles. And so we have chapter 8, which is Daniel's vision of the ram and the goat. Going to be kind of preparing the way to understanding the Antichrist, which is going to be expanded on later in the New Testament, especially in the book of Revelation. And then chapter 9 is Daniel's vision of the 77s. And I put it that way because if I put what I think it is, then that shows that I'm putting my interpretation ahead of what the text actually says. So I just put in what the text says, and we can figure out the interpretation when we get there. So it's Daniel's vision of the 77s, and that's not a football team or something like that, as we'll find out. And then the last section is Daniel's most detailed vision of the future, chapters 10 through 12. And so, is that too complicated? So, all right. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of the organization, the structure of the book, so that you can have a little bit of a view of how it fits together. Then, moving on, some general lessons from the book of Daniel. As we sort of wrap things up here, theologically, Daniel stresses the sovereignty of God. We've already alluded to that. That's a very major emphasis that comes out in this book. Specifically, it shows that God is wise enough and powerful enough to create and control history. Now, what's significant about that is that during this time in the Near East in general, people typically would credit some gods with having wisdom and some other gods with having power, but not normally the same God having both. But this is showing that God, the true God, God Most High, has both wisdom and power in one person because he is actual ultimate deity, not like the gods of the nations. And so that's what Daniel is going to be showing. God is wise and powerful. Philosophically, Daniel reveals the course and culmination of good and evil throughout human history. Now, the theme of good and evil is really a big deal because that's our whole understanding of what is going on in the world. Now, there are different understandings of it, some of which are faulty, but there is a correct understanding of that which is good and evil. And it goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, where it talks about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And most any movie or book that you read is dealing with the problem of good and evil. So it's a big deal. Everything has to do with that, even the things that we're dealing with in our own nation and the political context. There's the issue of good and evil going on there. That's the big theme. And so Daniel is dealing with that, the course and the culmination of good and evil throughout human history. So that's an important thing to remember. Hermeneutically, or having to do with interpretational principles, we observe that God teaches his people what will happen in the future by helping them appreciate what has happened in the past. Now, that sounds like that ought to just be perfectly logical. I mean, except for so many today don't appreciate history. If we would just go back and look at history, see how things have gone in the past, it really makes a difference for what our understanding is for the present as well as for the future. So the idea is we understand, we learn to understand the future by studying and understanding the past workings of God. So the better we understand what God has done in the past, the more advantage it will be for us understanding the future. And that's why we, when we find ourselves in difficulty and in times of depression or frustration, it's always good to look back. And that's where the whole principle of thankfulness comes from. Am I thankful? Well, what do I have to be thankful for? My life is miserable. Wait. God has worked in the past, and how he has worked in the past has implications for how he works in the future. And if God has worked in the lives of people in the past to bring them to the place where they need to be, then he can probably do that with me. He can probably do that with our nation as well. So we need to be reminded of that. So the future builds on the past and is an extension of the past, since God is working through all of history to the future, bringing it to fruition. So the point then is the literal fulfillment of prophecy encourages us to interpret the unfulfilled prophecies literally. So God has shown that he has fulfilled many of the prophecies in the past literally. We have every reason to believe he is going to continue to do that. With those things that have not yet been fulfilled, we should expect they will be fulfilled literally as well. Then, if you've got theologically, philosophically, hermeneutically, how about pedagogically? Well, I'm sure you know what pedagogy is. It's how to teach children. There's also another term called andragogy, how to teach adults. It's just kind of building on the same thing, just extending a little bit, realizing that children and adults are a little bit different in terms of how they learn. But we're talking about pedagogy, the basic idea of teaching, what things ought we to understand here. So pedagogically, we observe that God teaches us by going from the simple to the complex, from the known to the unknown. Those are some very basic teaching principles. You start with something you know, and then you move on to something else. If you want to try to teach me mathematics, start simple with something that I know, and then you can add something to it. Don't right away go into trigonometry or something, because I'm going to go, wait a minute, that's not my field of knowledge here. I need some help. So it's basically that idea. So this applies to when we look back on history. It has applications to how we look forward to prophecy. For example, God gave Daniel simple visions at first and then more complex ones later. They were building on them. And so if we get that basic idea, we say, oh, there's a progression here. So the first vision of Daniel is the most simple to interpret, and the last one is the most difficult to interpret. Hopefully by the time we get to the last one, we'll have figured out the first ones, and then it'll make sense. Or, I'm sorry, this way for you all. Then temporally, the book proceeds from what happened in the past to what will happen in the future. That's pretty easy to grasp and understand. And you can divide the book up, as we had kind of alluded to earlier. The first six chapters essentially deal with history, and the last six chapters deal with prophecy. For the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, that's kind of the idea. But we divided a little bit differently simply because the earlier one was dealing with the world, the Gentiles. The later ones were dealing more particularly with Israel. But the basic idea is moves from the past to future events. And then the last observation here, chronologically, the revelation in Daniel advances from the present to the near future to the far future from Daniel's perspective, because he's writing from what he sees it as. We're much further beyond in time, so some of the things that were future, near future to Daniel are still past to us. So that's kind of the idea that we're wanting to note there. So Daniel's perspective is going to be slightly different than ours, because we're in different places time-wise, 2,600 years, as we've pointed out. So those are just some things to keep in mind as we think about the book of Daniel. Then some concluding thoughts. The book of Daniel has a lot in it to think about and to work through. It's on one level, it's very simple, some great stories we can identify with and be encouraged by, but then there's a lot of other things that are rather much more in depth. It has much personal and world application. There's a personal identification that we can have with it, but also in terms of how to live in a pagan culture, but also as it relates to the world and what applies for the future. It has historical details, future anticipations, Because we're very much in a mindset when we're going through a difficult time of wondering, what does the future hold for us? A year from now, what will life be like? I mean, if you think back, a year ago, did you have any idea that we would be where we are today? It's just amazing how much has transpired. So we would like to know, what's going to happen next? Daniel gives us some insight into that. And then it gives us a taste of what it is like to live in a pagan culture as a believer, because that's very much what they had to do with. And then still remain devoted and true to the Lord in that time frame, in that context. Can we do that? And then we have a growing need to remain faithful in an increasingly pagan culture. We can identify with that, and we want to be encouraged to remain strong and courageous no matter what the circumstances are around us, as we see things, institutions, everything crumbling around us in some way. It can really make us nervous unless we're anchored to the Lord through all of it. So one of the things that I think that we see in Daniel is the importance of leadership, because there are different leaders that are referenced, and depending on how the leaders go and what the leaders' expectations are, it affects the people around them. And so as we conclude our service today, we are going to take just a couple of minutes to install our leaders and to recognize the importance of seeing our leadership in the context of the church is not the same as that which is out there. It's not that we have all the wisdom and insight, and you need to just look to us because we are so smart. We wish we were, but we know better, because we are just your servants, and we are responsible to the Lord. And that's when we do this installation, that's where we recognize we are the Lord's servants, and we are your servants as well. We serve one another. And so that's what we want to keep in mind.